I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Don't go. Please don't go. Yes, this is the math. It is the math show. But I promise you will not be quizzed, and we aren't going to take off any points if you can't solve for X or don't know how to find a square root using long division or a slide rule, or if you aren't even sure what square roots or slide rules are. Yes, today is the third time we've held a Vermont Edition math show, and we can guarantee that no one has failed in the other two. And in those episodes, we used math to determine the shape of space and how a butterfly flapping its wings in New Mexico really could cause a hurricane in China. So the curricula was really intense, or were really intense. Today, we're going to hear from mathematicians near and far who are working on some interesting things that have wound up on the Big Bang Theory and at Burning Man and incorporate beer and art and social media. Yes, math has its place in all of these things. And some of the people you'll hear from, and I'm not making this up, are not great with numbers. Shocking, but true. Joining me in the studio and helping us through this maze of math today will be Chris Danforth, a professor of mathematics and statistics at UVM. Chris, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Very happy to be here. Thanks.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. How do you apply math in your daily life? Or do you have some burning math question that keeps you up at night or at work? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post at vpr.org. Chris, you're going to start us off with a logic question to limber up our math minds and get us thinking on this Monday.
Let's do it. Okay, this one's called The Returning Explorer.
All right.
An explorer walks 1 mile due south, turns and walks 1 mile due east, turns again and walks 1 mile due north. He finds himself back where he started and shoots a bear. What color is the bear? The time-honored answer is white.
Right.
Because the explorer must have started at the North Pole.
Right.
But it turns out there are infinitely many other spots on the Earth like this, where you can walk 1 mile south, 1 mile east, and 1 mile north, and return back where you started. So where are they?
We don't have to answer all of them, but you can give us
you could pick
an
any extra ones.
So all right, because I got the North Pole. That one I got immediately in the white bear, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. All right. There's a question to start us off and get us moving on this math show. Chris, what inspired you to become a mathematician?
Well, I think when I was growing up, I was interested in trying to understand nature. My father was a material science professor and my mother was a modern dancer. So I was interested in learning about what the language of the natural world was. How do we describe what we see, the weather you mentioned as an example, but also our emotions? How can we explain them and understand them better?
And then what skill set should a person have to be a mathematician? Some aren't good with numbers, incredibly.
Yeah. So math's about a lot more than arithmetic. I think having an open mind and creativity and intellectual curiosity, those are the real things that you need to do well in math.
What has been the most gratifying part of being a mathematician for you?
Well, it's definitely getting to have the privilege of standing up in front of smart young people who are really interested in hearing about why the world works the way it does and getting to tell them all the cool things we figured out.
That's great. Well, now we're going to turn to someone who has been on all of the Vermont Edition math shows so far, Suthien Davidos. He's a former math professor at Williams College and is now the chair of the Applied Math Department at the University of San Diego. Suthien, welcome back to the math show.
Thanks so much, Rick. Great to meet you, Chris.
Good to meet you.
And I should mention that I was blown away when Suthien told me he is not good with numbers. I'm going to out him right off the bat. Right, Suthien?
Yeah, absolutely, my friend. It's I think very visually. I love to draw pictures. I love photography. So when it comes to numbers, all numbers look the same to me in terms of visually thinking about them. They all look like points on the number line, and I can't distinguish one point versus another one.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, you helped marry math and art against their parents' objections, of course. They do seem to be strange bedfellows. So why do you think this works, this marriage of math and art?
Well, I think if you push back a little bit to the time of the Renaissance, you know, this notion of worlds being pulled apart wouldn't even make any sense to them. Like, if you talk to Da Vinci and that crew in that area, they would say, well, math and art fit together. Like, Da Vinci in one hat was a mathematician and an engineer, and another hat was a scientist, and another hat was an artist, and he actually didn't even take his hat off. If you look at his scientific work, he's drawing works of art as he's talking about human anatomy. And so the switching gears never actually happened. He's one person who did everything. And the time of the Enlightenment kind of pulled us apart because we kind of went deep into each of these disciplines and we got to be very highly specialized people. And I'm just trying to, and along with several others, trying to kind of bring back together the time of the Renaissance. You know, how do we get together where these worlds can actually interact and benefit one another?
Well, how did you go about creating this intermingling of math and art? And I should mention it's with Owen Hsu, who now lives here in Vermont.
That's right. So the way to kind of go back to the Renaissance is to do it painfully and to suffer. In other words, there's no shortcut to bringing great art and math together. If you do shortcuts, actually, which is the easy way out in this, you know, Twitter world, is as a mathematician, you know, I kind of fool around with drawing pictures and doing that, and I kind of claim those are artworks. Or you have artists who are thinking about mathematics, but they're actually using mathematics from 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, or even 300 years ago, and they say, wow, look at this intersection of mathematics and art. But the way to really do it is just take somebody who's at the edge of mathematics, namely a mathematician who's thinking about great ideas, and at the same time take somebody who's a serious artist who's been struggling with art for their life, and to try to have them get together, break bread, have a cup of coffee. And this is how Owen and I met. I found him out in San Francisco when I was on sabbatical at Stanford, and we kind of met up for coffee once a week, and we kept in touch for about 2 years as we worked on this project together.
Taking it a step further, you worked with your students to create something for Burning Man. So first explain Burning Man.
So Burning Man is an interesting place. Burning Man is it started in San Francisco and quickly moved into the Nevada desert. It has now turned out to be the number one place for large scale sculptures. And actually, the Smithsonian just this year finished up a year long exhibit on the artwork in Burning Man. That exhibit's kind of on tour, but it has a little piece of kind of like a drug and drinking culture. I'd say about 15% maybe. And you could really look for that if you want to. But really the two other big pieces of Burning Man is deep notions of giving. What does it mean to kind of give sacrificially your works of art, your ideas, and your thoughts? And the second thing is build amazing engineering, artistic, mathematical feats of these beautiful sculptures. So that's what got me interested, is how do you take this notion of working with math and art that I worked with Owen as a painter, where Owen was this amazing painter, and took that and tried to think of a different work of art that lands in a 14-foot-tall, 2-ton sculpture. What can we do at that large scale?
And then what did your students create?
Actually, it was partly students, about 60 members of the community, faculty, amazing artists in the San Diego region, got together, and we built a dodecahedron, a 12-sided dice, except it's about 14 feet tall, and all the pentagonal faces unfold. And inside, it's lined with about 10-foot-tall mirrors, so when it closes up, you actually are in this amazingly mirrored room that is supposed to mimic and kind of point to what the shape of our universe could be. And the outside is lined with about 16,000 LED lights that move like the iconic movement of the Matrix animation.
One of the wonderful things about that project, I was just looking at it this morning, is that you give people a chance to interact with it. And I think that that's one of the fun things about mathematics that that people lose sight of as they get older is the playfulness and the exploration that can happen when you're doing that. So I thought that was really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I think one of the notions that I found most amazing about being at Burning Man, and the team was kind of reporting on this thing, was the incredible curiosity that both scientists, engineers, and mathematicians on one side have, but the same kind of curiosity that artists have. At the end of the day, it's not that, you know, the artists think differently in their approach to pushing the frontiers of this knowledge, but we're all hanging out, checking this stuff out, and going, well, why is this an unsolved math problem? Could you set this up for me? And this is a glorious time.
We'll go one more place with you, Suthian, and that's beer, which just got a lot of listeners' attention. So how did you apply math to beer?
So, you know, if you want to, what it actually was a curiosity of understanding I moved to San Diego. I've been in Williams and in the Berkshires and that area for about 15 years. And I moved to San Diego recently. And one of the big things about San Diego is its beer culture. It has about 160 breweries. One of the big centers of this microbrewery culture that had started since the 80s, if not even earlier. And I wanted to know how do you, as mathematicians, you're trying to measure things and compare things, and how do you compare beer? And it turns out that if you use numbers, it's not enough. Like, you know, if you think about numbers, they're all ordered for you. 16 is kind of next to 18, which is kind of far away from 68, and there's just kind of like number line ordering. And what I wanted to do is, how do you compare beer other than that? And the main ways beers have been compared have been this two groups of ales and lagers. But is there another way of comparing them? So I actually went to a brewing company, the San Diego Brewing Company, an old established company, and I asked them, what would you say is the genetics of beer? Like, what makes a beer a beer, rather than kind of title you'd give it? And the brewmaster said, well, it's basically the color, the bitterness, the pounds of grain, yeast, and they gave me about 11 genetic pieces, you know, the temperature, the cost, the time it takes to make it. And we took 21 beers, we took each of their 11 characteristics, and we, in some sense, put it into a genetic sequencing machine, and it kind of spit out a tree, a family tree of beers as the output. And it turned out that there, instead of two groups of ales and lagers, there turned out to be three groups. One group, according to this algorithm, one group was based on beer that was malty in taste and high in alcohol. The second group was high in hops and high in bitterness. And the third group was, what the heck? It was just like this random collection of, like, it didn't know what to do with them. So basically it was these three kind of family trees of beers that came out.
Wow. And will this help brewers in any way?
I think this goes back, Rick, to the partnership that you have with artists and the partnership you have with anybody as you talk about mathematics, which is you have to honor the craft of brewmaking. I cannot, as a mathematician, come in with a sense of arrogance and say, oh my gosh, now let me tell you the right answer. There's nothing like that. It's to partner with them, to work with them, and to say, does this help you? And they'd come back and say, you know what, that's actually useless for me, because these two beers that you think are really close, try it and see how radically different they are because you forgot smell. In fact, that's what we as brewmasters are trying to do, is to kind of push the boundaries of different things. So I think it's just the beginning of a long conversation you can have.
Sathyan Davidos is the chair of the Applied Math Department at the University of San Diego. Sathyan formerly worked in the math department at Williams College. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Chris.
All right, let's talk to Terry, who's calling us from Brattleboro. Terry, thanks for joining us. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I thought it would be relevant to share the fact that I went to school in the 50s and 60s, and I was never academically inclined, but I was very strong at math and art. And during that era, as I got older, the mathematical side was not encouraged, and I was not able to take mechanical drawing or get the support I needed to master algebra and that sort of thing. And I emphasized more on the visual arts. But as time went by, I found a fascination with gourds and mainly the ones with very unique shapes and sizes. And I've created art that is based on the gourd's individual geometric shape. And I had always had this ability to look at fairly complicated patterns and break them down and then work up from there. And I just wanted to share that as a woman who was often challenged against the very, you know, patriarchal world, but having skills that they often attributed to men. And I do have a website, tacarter.com, and there's a gallery on my gourds. But I just wanted to share that.
That's great. Thank you so much, Terry.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, there's a mathematics that was largely invented in the 1970s, specifically dealing with roughness. And up until that point, we had largely felt like most of the phenomenon in nature that we cared about were smooth, and the mathematics was really built up to understand that. And then fractal geometry was invented at that time to study things, like the stock market behaviors that exhibit structure at every length scale.
Oh,
and gourds
wow.
are like that.
Yeah. That's phenomenal. All right. Now listen to this. Thank you. Those are metronomes that started out of sync and then became synchronized. Chris Danforth, this is from a YouTube video. Explain what occurred.
That's very cool. So there are five metronomes set to slightly different frequencies, and these are used with musical instruments. They're on a wooden plank and initially are set out of phase with each other, and so you can hear them kind of clattering around. And about halfway through that clip, a gentleman places those places that plank on the top of two empty Coke cans turned on their side so that the plank itself can move back and forth a little bit. And what that does is it allows these metronomes to communicate with each other, effectively exchanging energy. And then over a few seconds, they end up syncing together. And so they clap basically at the end.
And this idea of synchronization goes back several hundred years. What happened then?
Right. So this is an example of a phenomenon that we call emergence, which is one of the most exciting new areas of science. And it really started back in the 1600s when ships were leaving – to be honest, ships were leaving England and getting lost a lot of the time. And there was a prize created to try and identify what the longitude was if you were out in the middle of the ocean. And so Christian Huygens was a scientist back then, and he decided that the best way to solve this problem was if you had two good clocks that were in sync with each other, one that was sitting back on land and one that was on your ship. And that way, when you were out in the middle of the Atlantic, you could judge based on how high the sun was at its peak, what latitude you're at, and then based on what time it was back in England, which you had an accurate representation of, you would know how far you had gone west. So when he was building all of his clocks to try and show how accurate they were, he invented the pendulum clock in this process. He realized at one point that all the clocks on the walls of his shop were syncing with each other and clicking together, and such that he would go around and set them to different phases from each other and let them go. And about 10 minutes later, they'd be clicking together again in sync. And he wasn't sure exactly what was going on, and definitely was upset that he was going to lose the prize because he can't make a good clock that keeps time. But basically, it turns out that there are small fluctuations in the wall. This is a wooden shop. And over time, the minimum energy state is for these things to be in phase with each other.
Does this happen in nature anywhere?
It happens everywhere in nature. So you've probably seen a video of fireflies that are flashing together in a group. There are examples of starlings that perform these beautiful murmurations. Schools of fish you would have been familiar with. There's even a species of ant that, you know, when it floods, these ants will all kind of grab together to each other and synchronize to form a raft that small mammals can work their way down the river on. And so, you know, it's an example of a phenomenon that we are trying to understand today in mathematics, using complex systems techniques to understand synchronization and emergence, where there's no individual that's in charge. In the case of the ants, for example, there's nobody saying, hey, we should all grab onto each other and survive this flood. You know, they have these little hydrophobic hairs on the bottom of their bellies, and they're just behaving in a way that's instinctive to them. And over time, evolution has produced a scenario where behaviors that no individual is responsible for collectively are beneficial.
Mm. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. It's our math show today. No, we're not asking you to solve any word problems. Well, our guest Chris Danforth of UVM's Department of Mathematics and Statistics has tossed one out for everyone to mull over. Chris, you want to ask that again?
Sure. So you're at a point on the Earth. You walk 1 mile south, you walk 1 mile east, and 1 mile north, and arrive back at the same place. So most people after a while will realize that this spot that you start at is the North Pole. But it turns out there are lots of other places that have the same property, and we're wondering where they are.
I still can't figure it out. Anyway, our next guest is a number theorist and retired mathematics professor at Dartmouth College, Carl Pomerantz. Carl, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
And Carl loves those prime numbers. I don't know who doesn't. Numbers only divisible by one and itself. Another big fan is Sheldon Cooper in The Big Bang Theory, especially the prime number 73. Let's let Sheldon explain why.
You're probably wondering why.
No, no, we're good.
73 is the 21st prime number. Its mirror, 37, is the 12th. And its mirror, 21, is the product of multiplying, hang on to your hats, 7 and 3. Huh? Huh? Did I lie?
Okay, Carl. Anything that Sheldon missed in his explanation of his conjecture?
No, no. In fact, he stated it as a fact, which is a little strange because in math, we usually need a proof before we state that a number is unique with a certain property. So he claimed on the show that there's only one right answer to his problem. There's only one prime like 73, where the reverse of it is also prime. And the other property is that 73 is the 21st prime, and the reverse of 73 is 37, and that's the 12th prime. And 21 and 12 are also the reverses of each other. And then he says, hang on to your hats, because 7 times 3 is 21.
So you set out to prove it. So did you prove it, and how were you able to accomplish it?
Well, I was working with a professor at a small college in Iowa. This is Chris Spicer at Morningside College. And we used computers, but it was more than that because there are infinitely many numbers, and computers can't search to infinity. They can only search to high levels. And so we had to use some deep facts about prime numbers that have been proved over the last 100 years, in particular the prime number theorem, which discusses how the primes are distributed within all of the numbers. They tend to thin out. They thin out at a certain rate. And we used those kinds of results to enable us to prove that 73 is unique.
You got your proof published. And then how did it wind up on the show The Big Bang Theory?
Well, that's sort of funny because when we wanted to include a photograph of Sheldon wearing a 73 T-shirt, which he wears periodically on the show, and we needed to get permission from the show to do this. So I did a little sleuthing and discovered that the show has a scientific advisor named David Salzberg, who's a physics professor at UCLA. So I emailed Salzberg and asked about getting permission to use the use a photo in our article. And at the same time, I sent him a copy of the paper. And he was just amazed that this paper should exist. The whole thing had started out as a joke on the show. And now here's this paper of two mathematicians proving it. So he got his permission to use the photo, and then he came back and said, can you give us permission to use your proof on whiteboards on the show? So we said, of course, that'd be fine. That's terrific. And in fact, that happened. So the show on April 18, which is just a few weeks ago, if you look at the background behind the characters talking about other stuff, you'll see some scribbles on the whiteboard, and it comes from our paper.
It's really terrific, Carl. I looked at your paper, and it's really impressive. I wanted to add one more fact about the number 73 that is perhaps a little more human-centered. And it turns out that if you ask people on the internet to report random numbers between 1 and 100, you ask them to just choose one, 73 and 37 get chosen at a rate much higher than other numbers. I think for some of the reasons that Carl's talking about potentially, but also because they're not even numbers. They're sort of not near the edges, and we have all kinds of strange reasons for what we think of as random. Humans are not good at being random. And of course, if people choose 73 most frequently, it's decidedly not the most random number between 1 and 100.
Wow. Well, Carl, congratulations on your proof. I should also mention that Carl has a primality test that bears his name, the Alderman Pomerantz Roomley test of prime numbers. So you really do love the prime, and we love you. Thank you, Carl. You're a retired math professor at Dartmouth College. We want to thank you for joining us on Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, let's talk to David, who's calling from Duxbury. Go ahead, David.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
So in full disclosure, I've heard this riddle many, many years ago. My uncle used to bring it out every Christmas to torment the adults. And when I was between 12 and 14, I was sitting at the kitchen table, a bench, and I laid down holding an orange above my head. And that's when I solved the riddle, the first solution, and realized there was a series of infinite other ones that can be expressed as, when you start any distance north of the South Pole, such that after you've walked a mile south, your mile east travel can be expressed in whole revolutions around the Earth, and you return to the same point.
Brilliant. And what do you think the relationship between you and the orange was that led this to work?
I was lying down, and it was above my head, so I was suddenly looking from the southern hemisphere instead of the northern hemisphere. And I think that's the trap that most of us are in when we approach that riddle. And the last thing is, my uncle never gave me credit for figuring it out.
So what's fun I like about this riddle is that, you know, people come up with lots of different solutions. I'll just restate the one you've given so that the listeners have a chance to hear it again. So if you start more than a mile away from the South Pole, and let's say a mile and a half, and you walk a mile south, and you need to be able to walk a distance such that when you stop, you can even see the South Pole. You're now going to follow one of the latitude lines around that South Pole in a circle that you would be able to see the entire time yourself on this track. When you get back, you've been walking a mile east, back where you started, and then you walk a mile north and you're back where you began.
Fantastic. David, did you go into math as an occupation?
No, I was horrible at math.
Well, not horrible. You actually solved a wonderful question. Thank you so much. Chris, you've used statistics to uncover some things in social media. So what are some of the studies you've conducted about happiness in social media?
Yeah. So amazingly, there are 500 million messages posted to Twitter every day. And if we wrote them down on Post-its, they would wrap around the Earth's equator once. So over the last decade, our research team, together with Peter Dodds and other students at UVM, we've used that data source to try and understand lots of different aspects of human behavior. We've shown, for example, that there are more happy words than sad words in a dozen languages. We've built an instrument to measure people's day-to-day happiness based on Twitter. We've looked at building instruments that quantify how many calories people are taking in or spending with exercise and other activities using Twitter. And it's amazing how much we reveal. So more recently, we looked into trying to understand what the differences were between people who'd been diagnosed with a mental health problem, their activity on social media. We found that their Instagram photos were bluer and darker and grayer and had less faces in them than people who had never been diagnosed with depression. Mm. So we reveal an enormous amount about ourselves with what we say online, and we're trying now to figure out how to use that information to help people.
Excellent. Our next guest, Chris, is Tom Payor. He's a math teacher at Winooski High School and Vermont's 2019 Teacher of the Year. He's had to duck out of the classroom for a few minutes to join us today. So, Tom, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello, Chris and Rick. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Big fan of the show.
Tom, take me into a math class as you teach it in your school today.
All right. So, great thing. I just want to start off. A colleague of mine used to say, is math invented or discovered? And we run with the idea that it's discovered. It's out there. It's around us. It's something we've put symbols to. And if it's discovered, that means anybody can discover it. So I really run my classroom with a sense of discovery, where you may remember yourself in a math classroom and here's the formula, it's on the board, we're going to talk about it a little bit and then go ahead and practice it. It doesn't really happen in my classroom or in Winooski in general. What we do is we present them with a situation or a problem and ask them to come up with a strategy to solve it. And then from that strategy to generalize, is what we're doing, is it true all the time, sometimes, or never? And from that, to be able to create their own formulas, their own equations that they can apply to literal events in their own world.
Does this work at all skill levels and grade levels?
It does. What's really interesting with the students that I work with is they're coming with such vast backgrounds and differences and experiences with mathematics. And literally with language barriers. So allowing students that opportunity to explore with one another and to critique and debate ideas across different understandings, everybody ends up learning. Everybody's idea gets thrown out there. Everybody has the chance to say, I think it works like this, and then to have that idea critiqued by others. And we do this kindergarten through 12th grade.
Wow. And what kind of math projects have your students taken on?
So I like to provide students the opportunity to explore social issues. When I was in college, I studied economics. It's something that's personal and passionate to me. And I find that my students are also really interested in the world that's going on around them. So some projects that we've done in the past, we've looked at the data set from the World Value Survey. That's given about every 4 to 6 years to different countries across the world and just ask them about social phenomena. I ask students to find correlations or to take a look to see if they can find correlations between any big interesting ideas. Like, one student of mine had done a project looking at levels of female education and seeing if it correlated to people's responses to the question, if you would, how willing would you be to have people of a different religion as your neighbor? Hmm. And they might find a correlation, they might not, but what they begin to do is they start talking about what are the variables that impact this and how strong is the correlation and what else might be at play here. And they get that opportunity to just think a little bit more deeply about an idea and question their own long-held beliefs with real numbers and data.
Tom Payor is a math teacher at Winooski High School, and he's Vermont's 2019 Teacher of the Year. Tom, thanks so much for letting us know about what your students are doing with math.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We also heard from Wesley, who writes, I graduated from SUNY Albany in 1979 with a dual major in math and physics and an MS in math in 1982. In the employment food chain, math is the plankton which feeds careers. It was my ticket to numerous positions and subpositions in industry and education, including 31 years at UVM. Math rocks. You can't go wrong with math. And I know, Chris Danforth, you agree with that as well.
That's terrific and fun to hear Tom talk about how the students are benefiting from being able to explore that idea with correlations and just using their hands where they can. And it's not just arithmetic.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri for Jane Lindholm. With me in the studio is UVM mathematics and statistics professor Chris Danforth. And we're now joined by Emily Proctor, a mathematics professor at Middlebury College. Emily, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I'm going to out Emily, too. She admits to being weak at subtraction.
<It's true>.
Now, the last time you joined us, Emily, you were teaching a class on the shape of space. So just very briefly explain that pursuit.
Oh, yeah. I think if you typically when people think about like the shape of the universe or space, they just kind of think, oh, it just goes off forever and ever in all directions and don't really think about the fact that maybe it's actually a finite volume that we actually live in. And so the same way that if people, if you're on a really big sphere, you might think, oh, it's just a huge plane and goes on forever and ever and not recognize that you're actually on the surface of a sphere. Our universe could actually also be kind of wrapping back around on itself. And there's sort of a finite number of shapes that could build that up. And we explore those shapes in that class.
Wow. Now, from science, we go to history. You really seem to have a love for how math has gotten to where it is today, going back to 300 BC.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just finished up another class, like today. what we looked at in that class was sort of the history of geometry and how it really has evolved over time. So Euclid in 3000 or 300 BC wrote Elements, and pretty quickly after he wrote it, a lot of mathematicians started poking at it and looking at it carefully and stuff, and they sort of had this kind of feeling that it wasn't quite right. So he had done an amazing thing by taking all of the known results about geometry at the time and organizing them into his Elements, because he was working from scratch, more or less, he had used some intuitive arguments, and that they weren't really sort of founded in, they weren't completely grounded. And so mathematicians for like 2,000 years basically poked and prodded. And then eventually, 2,000 years later, sort of realized, they started to understand kind of some places where he had made assumptions and then also realized where they could drop some of his assumptions and create new types of geometry.
So did Euclid get it right pretty much?
Yeah, he definitely did. Yeah, he did an amazing job. It was his work is, even though he had made these a few small assumptions along the way, the work that he did was right. And in fact, in about the turn of the 20th century, David Hilbert came along and who was a huge mathematician of the time and fixed it. He essentially re-axiomatized what Euclid had done and kind of shored up the edges and proved all of the results that Euclid had proven.
Does mining the history of math make it more tangible for students you teach?
I think so. I think that we're so used to math being sort of just handed to us as if it's like the final, it's this concrete thing that just has a complete existence. But I think that going back and kind of looking under the hood a little bit about how it was developed was really helpful. First of all, it gives people sort of a recognition that there are choices that we make in how we talk about math and how we axiomatize it, so it's not necessarily this fixed thing. It's just a way that we codify it so that we can actually talk about it. And then also, I think it helps the students too, because this was a class for sort of beginning majors, and so it helps them to realize, yeah, you don't get it right always at first. Sometimes you have to go back and fix things. And so it's kind of, for me, it felt very liberating to think about it that way.
Chris Danforth, do you find the same thing?
Yeah, I was just going to say that there's sort of this myth of the lone genius who's, yeah, you know, locked away in an office with a pencil and paper for a decade. And in reality, math is a very collaborative experience, and the internet's enabled it to be more so. And it's as much of a group activity as any other endeavor.
I should mention that Suthyan Davidos, who we had on earlier from the University of San Diego, is working on a math studio that will open next spring. And it'll do exactly what you're talking about, a more collaborative approach to working on math. Emily, what are you currently researching?
My research is actually sort of like at the far other end from Euclid. It does actually, you can trace a trajectory right from Euclid up to what I do, but I work on they're mathematical objects called orbifolds. The most simple one that you can think of is a sphere. But then you can actually, that's an example of a two-dimensional orbifold, but you can actually work in many dimensions. You can work in any dimension you want, and the shapes can be really, really crazy. So they have, once you get going with it, you can actually generalize the idea of the sound that a guitar string makes, and you can give every geometric object a sound, or like the type of geometry that I do, you can give it a sound. And so I'm looking at how the sounds of the, how orbifold sound changes when you start deforming the orbifolds.
Oh, wow. Would Euclid?
Yeah, it's kind of a shocker, I guess.
Would Euclid approve of what you're doing?
I hope so.
Wow. Emily Proctor is a mathematics professor at Middlebury College. I want to thank you for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right. And we still have UVM mathematics and statistics professor Chris Danforth. So, Chris, let's talk about algorithms, because we hear a lot about this, and they're used to kind of predict behaviors and seemed a bit, I don't know, maybe a dirty word right now with some people. So first, make the case for why algorithms are good.
Yeah, so I think that one helpful idea is to maybe talk about them like recipes when you're cooking. You know, you have a list of things, the ingredients you're going to put in, and hopefully you get something delicious at the other end. And there are lots of examples day to day where algorithms help us do things, like when you go on Amazon and you type in something that you're looking for, and it shows you some things that other people looked at. That can be really useful, it turns out, and so can Google search results. And so there's a lot of advances that algorithms have enabled, but a lot of them are trained on human behavior, and we have biases associated with our behavior that we're often not aware of. And so there can be times when algorithms encode problems that human beings have.
Is that a problem?
It oftentimes can be. So for example, we often look at things like arrest statistics to try and understand where criminal activity is happening. And you might decide that if you have lots of arrests happening in this particular neighborhood, then lots of crimes happening there, and you should maybe send more police to go visit that neighborhood. When in reality, there are crimes happening in other places and there just aren't police there observing them. And so these sorts of algorithms can, if they're trained on data like that, they can end up encoding biases in the way our institutions work. And so that's one of the challenges.
So what are you looking at now when it comes to algorithms?
Yeah. So there's really a new field being created called algorithmic fairness. And the idea here is to try and understand what which pieces of data are being used to train algorithms, and then trying to build mathematical tools to encode our value system and ethics into what should be a really objective process but can sometimes not be.
So what would the practical application be when your research is complete?
Sure. So we recently received a gift from the Mass Mutual Life Insurance Company. to try and understand algorithmic fairness in decision making and accountability. And one outcome would be developing tools that enable decisions made by algorithms to be interrogated. So one of the challenges is a lot of the fanciest machine learning techniques that will be most predictive on a data set. It's difficult to understand how they came to the conclusions that they came to, despite the fact that they're really predictive. A bit of a black box. You may have heard that phrase before. So one of the outcomes would be techniques to try and make that black box more transparent so we can understand what data is going in and why it's making the decisions that it's making.
And merging your two worlds, because you do so much research into social media. So will this have applications to social media? Algorithmic fairness?
I believe that it will. So for example, certainly the transparency part would. So you hear in the news a lot about Facebook's news feed and how we're seeing what we see. I think that in the case of trying to use people's social media data to sell them things or advertise to them, it feels maybe a little more innocuous than if we were making decisions about how long they'll live, for example, like a life insurance company does. And so in this case, we're going to be working with them to try and make sure that the algorithms they use to infer how long they think you'll live, that they're fair and unbiased.
Now, you started the show by asking a logic question. I want you to restate it and then give the answer that we did get from one of our listeners today in case anybody missed the answer.
Sure thing. So this is a great puzzle. I think if for anybody who's interested in supporting let's say you have kids who are interested in math and you're looking to give them some extra stuff, there's a puzzle book published by Martin Gardner. And then there's other books like Steve Strogatz has a book on sync and infinite powers is another new one. There's a YouTube channel, 3Blue1Brown, if you're interested in this sort of stuff. Okay, so the puzzle. You're standing on a point on the surface of the Earth. You walk a mile south, then you walk a mile east, and then you walk a mile north. And you arrive back where you started. So the North Pole fits this equation because the longitude lines are straight and parallel to each other, and they meet at the North Pole. But it turns out there are lots of other places on the Earth like this, and your job is to figure out where they are. So if you imagine being near the South Pole now, and this is where it helps to have a globe in front of you, or an orange for that matter.
as our listener did.
Right. So you're a little more than a mile from the South Pole, and you walk south on one of the longitude lines, and maybe you end up just a few feet from the South Pole. And you walk a mile east in a circle, kind of in place basically around that. And if you end up back where you started and walk a mile north, then you're back back where you began.
Now, you're a mathematician and a statistician. You've heard from – we heard these other mathematicians today. So I want to know, what did you learn today from the math show?
Well, it's just remarkable the breadth with which this type of thinking can be applied to understand the world. And we've just scratched the surface barely, but we heard from many people working on different types of problems. And again, it's a lot more about being creative and thinking about why things work the way they do than it is getting the answer right.
And you're not going to say that 73 is the best number of all.
It's definitely the most random number between 1 and 100.
Chris Danforth is a professor of mathematics and statistics at UVM, and he's now a veteran of two Vermont Edition math shows. Until the next one, Chris, thank you so much.
Had a great time, Rick. Thank you.